I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress that is trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. It's a great mattress at a very reasonable price point. Comes with a 20-year warranty and a great deal for our listeners. Douglas is giving you a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. That is douglas.ca/CanadaLand. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. There is an incredible facility right here in downtown Toronto that is helping on the front lines and is doing incredible innovative research. They are a facility that treats everybody with dignity, and they need your help. May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. If this matters to you, help CAMH. There's no better place for your resources. Go to CAMH.ca/CanadaLand and donate now. Help CAMH treat addiction and build hope.
Once at the Capitol, the crowd became unruly.
Smashing doors and windows, invading the office of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, and stealing laptops.
Shots were fired inside the Capitol Hill building.
A Capitol Hill police officer has died as a result of his injuries that he sustained during Wednesday's riots at the Capitol.
The FBI in Washington now using Twitter to seek tips.
How about the member of the mob who sat with his feet up on Nancy Pelosi's desk?
If you don't like it, send somebody after me, but I ain't going down easy.
Of course, if they arrested him on Wednesday, they wouldn't have to be looking for them now, but they are. And here's another man that they're looking for, the one who carried off a lecture.
So far, nearly 100 people have been arrested and charged.
But Ryan, now facing jail time, is looking for help from the president.
Plus, Twitter purged. The social network deletes more than 70,000 accounts tied to QAnon.
Meanwhile, Apple, Google, and Amazon Web Services ended their support for the social media network Parler.
Parler sues Amazon for suspending access to their web servers. So how far will tech giants go to keep this competitor offline?
The hunt is on for the murder plotters, the pipe bomb builders, the cop assaulters, the armed terrorists who stormed Washington, D.C. So far, as I record this, they've arrested more than 100 of them. Just over 100 out of thousands of people who broke United States federal law. But I get it. They've all gone home. And we don't know exactly who was caught up in that crowd. I mean, if only we could somehow get them all into one big place where the authorities could just round them all up at once. Oh well. Spilt milk, I guess. Better late than never. Listen, there are serious and unanswered questions about why law enforcement was not prepared for the mob. Members of which had been planning the whole thing online, in public, planning to kidnap and kill and commit treason for weeks. Unanswered questions about the delays in sending in the National Guard. And more unanswered questions still about why some of the cops who were there didn't do more before blood was spilled. But today, we're going to focus on what is being done now to identify the criminals who strolled out of the chambers of the U.S. Senate and House of Representatives untouched after wreaking mayhem. And the work we're going to focus on the most effective efforts in exposing these goons, it's not being done by the cops. It's being done by technologists, sort of. Researchers, analysts, maybe call them journalists. It's being done by people on the internet. It is not totally clear what to call these people. But there is a name for their tactics. It's called OSINT, Open Source Intelligence. It involves a distributed, crowdsourced, largely volunteer workforce of thousands of hobbyists, I suppose, who track down videos and pictures and satellite imagery and social media messages and put it all together in one place, index it, analyze it, and compile timelines to track individuals in the mob like walking needles in a haystack. Their goal is to match online personas to photos of faces to names of people. To take the blurry pic, the screen grab of the back of the head of a man who's assaulting a cop, and then track it back through other photos and videos until you can see the guy's face or get a better look at his clothing or a tattoo, and then scour through databases of other photos of Facebook posts, MAGA rallies, or whatever you can find until you, and the thousands of people doing it with you, get a name. And it better not be the wrong name. Chuck Norris was not there. Open source intelligence works best when it's done by lots of people. Ironically, it takes a mob to catch a mob. But mobs are unwieldy things. Today we're going to look closely at both the current efforts to ID the Washington mob perps, including the Canadians among them, and we're going to look way back at the roots of open source intelligence in Canada by talking to the guy who has been doing it before, I think, anybody, and doing it for over a decade. Until recently, he did so anonymously. But he is now out and doing this work under his own name. And you'll hear that name and you'll hear from him later on today. But first, I'm going to talk to Eric Toller, head of training and research at Bellingcat. Bellingcat is an investigative organization with a small staff and a huge army of volunteers, and they are the leading practitioners of open source intelligence. Their investigations have solved mysteries that stumped traditional journalists. They exposed the Russian agents who poisoned opposition leader Alexei Navalny, and they found out that it was a Russian missile that took down that Malaysian plane in 2014. They had better reporting on the motives of the Christchurch killer than anybody, and they are now leading the efforts to identify the worst members of that mob in Washington, and to provide an accurate demographic picture of just what sort of people showed up in that mob. As you're going to hear today, it's not the powerless losers that you might have thought. Bellingcat takes its name from an Aesop's fable about a group of mice who decide that the only way to protect themselves against a stealthy, predatory cat is to tie a bell around its neck that'll give them a warning. But who among them, the mice ask, will take on the dangerous task of belling the cat? Eric Toller joins me from his home in Kansas City in a moment. Wait for it. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Alex, Gustavo Casso, Sean McLean, Sai, Nathaniel Lewis George, Kelsey Walshy, Diane Abunem, and Katie.
My name is Katie. I am from Kitchener. I teach at the University of Waterloo, and I support Canada Land because it keeps me up to date on what is going on across the country. But I've kept listening and I've kept supporting because I feel like Canada Land gives me a perspective that I don't get anywhere else.
Tell me what you've been doing since the assault on Capitol Hill. Take me through your process a bit.
So we're finding as many photos and videos as we can of the storming, and we're trying to archive them, keep them retained, and preserve them for future historians or researchers or whatever. So a lot of this is informed by our work around the Charlottesville protest back in 2017, because I remember when I was doing research on that, I was going through kind of, you know, during the day of and the morning after the protest, I was going through and downloading as many videos and photos and live streams as possible from the event, because Heather Heyer was killed during the protests, and then there were criminal charges passed and people were being fired from their jobs and all that. And the people who had been, you know, holding their phones up and recording and live streaming, they were suddenly realizing, like, it's probably not a good idea for me to have a video of me at this fascist rally or whatever. So they were deleting it. And I ended up saving a lot of them, but there are a ton of videos and photos that disappeared into kind of the ether of the internet, never to be seen again because people deleted them, or they would be taken down by platforms as, you know, radicalization, extremism, whatever. And the same thing here with the Capitol storming. For every person who had like a weapon or whatever, you had 20 people who were holding up their phones who were recording your live streaming what was going on, because this is kind of an internet clout coup attempt almost, as everyone was taking photos, they were posing, they were live streaming, they're on Periscope or Parler or Facebook or whatever. So we aren't super interested in kind of the doxing efforts about identifying the individuals in here. I mean, though that's interesting on its own, but we're more interested in the archival effort for current people trying to understand currently what's happening, you know, exactly what happened, who was involved, what groups, who was on the vanguard, I guess you could say, but also for future historians and researchers to, it's only been a week or so since the storming, but you can already imagine there's going to be dissertations and books and God knows how many research projects about those, you know, 3-4 hours of the storming. And in order for that to happen, for us to have a really strong understanding of exactly how it happened, what the group dynamics were, who was doing what, the insights we don't really have for other things, like imagine the Russian Revolution, the people storming the Winter Palace in 1917. You know, we have recollections and firsthand accounts and all that, but we don't have video footage of it. But here, I'm not trying to say this is the same as the storming of the Winter Palace, but with the event of, storming seat of power, now we have, literally hundreds of photos and videos and thousands of photos and videos of the event as it happened from different angles and perspectives.
I can understand why you would shy away from what you call the doxing part of it and focus on what I think is pretty much universally accepted as a public good. The fact that these documents of incredible historical importance are being deleted either by the people who shop them, so because they realize they've incriminated themselves, or by the deplatforming of individuals and entire platforms vanishing. So there's this limited window where you can actually get the stuff that matters, and so future generations can figure out what the hell happened. But come on. We're in a moment right now where we are reckoning with what actually went on. There were two guys there with like what are those plastic zipline handcuffs? Right. So like, who the hell were those guys and what were they planning? And then you go and you can go through the open source intelligence and see what they were planning. They were planning to kill people. So it's not just about the doxing efforts, if we're going to call it doxing, which I think has a very negative connotation.
Of course, yeah.
This is about more than just finding out who trespassed or, narking on protesters who went too far. There were people there with murderous intent. There were two pipe bombs that were discovered. So there is a robust open source effort to identify people. Mm-hmm. There's a few Canadians who are there. And maybe Bellingcat wants to provide that visual data for anybody to do anything with, but you can't, that people are using it right now for that explicit purpose, and you're playing an important role in that process of identifying the perps, right?
Yeah, of course. I mean, we're trying not to facilitate the actual effort themselves because it can go haywire pretty easily, the actual doxing, I guess you could say doxing or identification efforts. But we've definitely helped with and kind of facilitate a little bit of the most extreme ones. So, for example, there's John Scott Railton, who you probably know, who's at U Toronto. He was working with Ronan Farrow at The New Yorker and doing some identification of some of these people who are the most egregious, I guess you could say, right? So the people who, the zip tie person who's carrying those zip tie handcuffs, he identified both of them, actually. Mm-hmm. Well, in order to do that identification, you have to have a gigantic base to work off, right? The scaffolding of hundreds of thousands of videos and photos, you can't do the identification without that stuff. Because again, you have to have different angles of the person's face. Maybe you can see them chatting with their friends, before in the rally, like, hey, what's your name? Where are you from? That kind of thing. They're all talking to each other during the rally before the storming. But yeah, we're not so interested in identifying the random middle-aged woman who was carrying a flag into the Capitol and just kind of walks around in her phone and leaves.
The carnivalesque atmosphere where people are filming themselves and like, wow, this is fun, is a social phenomenon that probably is going to be studied as well. And but the tension, when you say it can go haywire, I mean, no journalist wants to act as an arm of law enforcement. Mm-hmm. And I think that negative association with doxing is when it's these kind of, I hesitate to say, oh, just the everyday regular people who are storming the Capitol.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I don't know, just reading your own accounts, a lot of retired cops and military people, concerningly, were there.
Not even retired. There were a lot of off-duty cops who, they took some vacation days from the NYPD or Chicago PD and then, flew down to DC. This I mean, this is a common misconception about these people is, you know, a lot of, I think the Atlantic probably got a lot of flack for this, and they published a story about how the people who stormed the Capitol were the, you know, these losers, these unemployed, I call them, I think they call them like Pornhub addicts is what they called them. Uh-huh. So these losers who were, you know, just had nothing else in life, whatever. No, that's not true at all. The people who were storming the Capitol, like, of course you had the losers, right? You had the, you know, the people in the mom's basement or whatever, but they were a big time minority. The people I've looked for, the people who have been arrested and the people that we've noticed who are there. Like if I were to rank from CEO company right down all the way to unemployed loser, I'd think that like the median or the aggregate of them is something like a real estate agent. There are so many real estate agents who love like MAGA and QAnon stuff.
That's weird.
And a lot of cops, both retired and off duty. A lot of soldiers and veterans. I can't even, like literal, like, you know, Air Force lieutenants and stuff who were involved here. Lots and lots of cops, a ton of small business owners, stuff like that. So this isn't like, a lot of people trying to portray this as some kind of like populist, like grassroots, you know, like coup or color revolution or whatever. And that's not true at all. The person who was storming the Capitol was someone who could afford a plane ticket to go to DC, who could take time off of work, who has vacation days, who owns a business, right? And they can go do it themselves. And who can do all this and also, you know, flaunt, you know, pandemic and rules and all that stuff.
Yeah. And some of whom have military training, mm-hmm. they're armed. Some of them have the responsibility to enforce the law. That's just absolutely terrifying. I have no problem with their identities being known when they're out, mm-hmm. you know, in public doing these things. The work in Charlottesville, like that was a turning point where I think it slowed the movement of these extreme right groups, because that guy in the cubicle next to you is in one of those videos, and there are questions and concerns about him at work the next week. And I think it drew into stark relief, like, sure, you're free to do various types of things in public, but there are going to be consequences, and a lot of people are going to, you know, not want to be around you or have you as an employee if that's the case. Why are you so hesitant? Like, what is the worst case scenario where you've seen it go haywire, where you've seen things go bad with you know, open source intelligence piling on and, you know, doxing or whatever you want to call it?
Yeah, I mean, it could very easily go the wrong way. I think there was an article I saw recently about someone who, I can't remember who it was, but someone was misidentified and their family's being harassed and their employer and all that stuff. So it's quite easy to misidentify these people. But also, on the other hand, these people are repeat offenders. For example, there's a 3%er guy who was in the Capitol, kind of, I guess you could say, the vanguard, not to romanticize it, but like kind of in the front lines of the attack on the police and then into the Capitol, whatever. And if you see this guy, if you follow militias and 3%ers and that sort of thing, you might recognize him because he's a regular in a lot of these. And his face was relatively unmasked. And, you know, even when he kept his face masked up, you know, a lot of times they, because just like, you know, the average person, you pull your mask down to cough or to talk to somebody or whatever, and you put it back up. And when that happens, there's 1,000 cameras around you that'll capture you because with a good shot of the face. So a lot of these people, you know, you have, you know, the boat dealership people who you know, kind of the middle class people who do that. But you also have a lot of Proud Boys, 3%ers and militia types who, if you search their faces on Google and make search, or if you look into, you know, membership roles and previous videos and stuff, you'll see them and recognize them from previous events. So a lot of the doxing of the most violent people is not super fraught. There's one guy, for example, who was pulling the zip ties, and he was wearing the exact same clothes in the Capitol as he did in other like anti-lockdown protests in Tennessee. Like he wore like the exact same clothes over time. And you know, you have things like tattoos and birthmarks and stuff like that helps too. But when you wear the exact same clothes in multiple public protests, then, you know, it makes it kind of easy to identify someone. So for that kind of stuff, when it's like very obvious, right? This guy also brought his mom to the protest. So that's, you know, you look and you find his Facebook page and you see him with his mom, the exact same person. And
he brought his mom?
Yeah, yeah. So this guy one of the guys in the famous photo of the guy carrying the zip ties on the floors of Congress. I think most people have seen that kind of famous photo. He brought his mom to the protest. And there's other videos of him walking from the Trump rally to the Capitol, and he's walking with his mom. He's been arrested now, but if you find his Facebook, him and his mom, you know, posed together photo after photo.
So both in terms of being confident that it's a positive ID and that this is a person who like should be exposed, you feel pretty good about that one. Another challenge, though, for you, I mean, a lot of people are celebrating right now the deplatforming of tens of thousands of QAnon accounts, Trump's many accounts, Parler itself being booted off of the internet functionally. But that just erases tons of data that is of high interest and value to you.
Yeah, so there's a few things going on right now. So there's self-deletion, self-censorship, right? Where people who come home realizing, I don't want to lose my job, I better delete this video, right? So that's one thing. There's platform-based stuff that kind of anti-extremism. So this is something we dealt with a lot. We look at things like conflict and war videos and war crimes and things like that. So platform-based stuff, that's happening now at the Capitol protests, where Facebook specifically is taking down some photos and videos of the storming just because it shows illegal activity and radicalization and all that. Parler was nuked, as everyone knows, it's taken down, but most of the stuff has been retained. People managed to scrape pretty much everything off the site. It was like pretty much like run off a WordPress site practically. And so it was very easy to scrape everything. So for example, we went through and looked at every video on the 6th, on the day of the storming, that was had geo-coordinates near DC, near the Capitol. And we have a few hundred or a few thousand of those. A handful of them, like I said, maybe 10 or so were actually inside of the Capitol, but some of them are really interesting. It shows them fighting with the cops, and one of them, I think they're in like the subway, kind of like underneath it, and they were like, there's really crazy video, like the cops are trying to shut the door to keep them from coming out, but then they come and push the door up and they threw a chair at the cop retreated and everything. So yeah, there's some crazy videos that weren't seen before because they were relatively obscure on Parler, because Parler wasn't very big. The site was horrible to use, so a lot of stuff that even got uploaded wasn't seen because the site was constantly going down. It was hard to use, and the search function was like non-existent too. So a lot of really interesting videos were on Parler that are now being discovered from this scrape, just because Parler wasn't a super popular platform. And the same videos are put onto YouTube or Instagram, they might have spread a lot more.
So one last question for you. If in your research and your colleagues' research, you come across plans for something like the siege on Washington that have plans for something that hasn't happened yet, what do you do with that information?
I mean, we probably, I don't know, post it online. Like, we don't report it to the cops or the feds or anything like that. I know some people do, but we don't. Like, we haven't said anything to the FBI tip line, and we haven't said anything to the cops or anything, just because, I mean, this is not, like, sophisticated. Like, this, like, if you just search the word capital, like, you know, both capital with an AL and OL, because they misspell it too, on the Donald or on Parler from, the week before, I mean, they were just, it was hashtag storm the Capitol. Like, this wasn't a secret, right? It's not like, we had the secret information and then our tip will blow it up. Like, they have billions and billions of dollars of surveillance and domestic surveillance and, the Patriot Act and everything else where they can have all these broad sweeping powers. And yet, these people are just sitting here on the Donald and Parler saying, hashtag storm the Capitol. Here's a map. This is what we're going to do. This is exactly what we're going to do it. And they did exactly what they said they were going to do, right? So no, we don't report anything to see it, because even if we did it, what would happen? So just keep that in mind when the next, when they pass the domestic surveillance bill in about 6 months or so to prevent this from happening again, just keep that in mind that they already have these things and nothing happened.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. We got a tour of their facilities in their downtown Toronto campus, and I was blown away by the heroic work that these people are doing. They are saving lives every day. I know people whose lives were saved, and they just really care about the dignity of the people who turn to them for help. Look, we talk a lot about these issues on Canada Land. We talk about the crisis that is claiming 20 lives every day in Canada to drug overdoses, but we don't give you a lot of options of what you can do about it. CAMH is an option. CAMH desperately needs resources that they directly put into their work, saving lives and turning people's lives around. Listen, May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. This is when they need your help the most. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand to help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp, therapy online that has served over 3 million people around the world, and it's available here in Canada. And this time of year, we're all emerging from our winter-like seclusion and, patio season and socializing, and it can be terrifically fun, but it can also create a lot of pressure. And some people get, like, anxiety, social anxiety from being out too much. What did Iggy Pop say about social life? It's torture dressed as fun. It doesn't need to be torture. I think it's just about finding, like, the right balance of how much of other people do you want? I mean, we need each other, but I think that at a certain point, it can become overwhelming. And talking to somebody about yourself, about your social life, about your relationships is a way of gaining insight into what is right for you. It's not selfish to examine that with a professional. And as the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Listeners of the show get 10% off of their first month at betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. That's better, H-E-L-P, betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. The digital Nazi hunt began long before Bellingcat, and a big part of it began in Canada. Since 2007, a janky-looking blog called Anti-Racist Canada has been exposing area Aryans and other homegrown goons. At first, it was a LiveJournal site. Then, it moved to Blogger. Over years in which few in the media were taking the radical right seriously, the anonymous author of Anti-Racist Canada spent thousands of hours researching and posting thousands of articles on the various hate groups of Canada and their members. He built up a sizable audience of law enforcement, of journalists who sometimes borrowed his reporting, often without credit, and of the racists themselves, who pored over every word posted on Anti-Racist Canada and who sent its anonymous author death threats on the regular. And then, last January, he was exposed. A post on Rebel News ran with the headline, "Antifa Informant Exposed, School Teacher Kurt Phillips of Drumheller." Kurt Phillips is the formerly anonymous author of Anti-Racist Canada and currently a founding board member of the Canadian Anti-Hate Network.
My name is Kurt Phillips. I am a high school teacher in southern Alberta.
And what do you do when you're not teaching high school?
When I'm not teaching high school, I'm hunting Nazis.
You've been hunting Nazis on the internet since before it was cool.
Well, yeah. I mean, I started in the late 1990s, early 2000s, when I was in University of Regina. I started following and keeping tabs on some of these hate groups, partly because I was just fascinated by the mentality, but also kind of the horror that these are people who are also harming people.
I'm catching you at a particular moment. Have you been involved over the past week and a bit in investigating the people who took part in the siege on the U.S. Capitol? And I'm thinking specifically some of the Canadians we know were there.
Yeah, I have been, actually. And there are a bunch of us who are with the Canadian Anti-Hate Network. We're trying to figure out specifically who the guy with the Canadian flag is. We've got some leads. We're kind of trying to track those down. Nothing definitive yet, but he's left some breadcrumbs for us to follow.
I just spoke to a gentleman from Bellingcat, and they're kind of pioneering this whole new field of OSINT, of open source intelligence gathering. I guess you were doing that before it was called that.
Apparently, yes. I don't think I ever had the level of skills that some of the people had. I was more of a, you know, when you're trying to crack a safe, just trying every single combination. If you looked at the blog, it was obvious I was not particularly technically savvy.
You had a very homemade spot on the web at a time when the Nazis and the extreme right had their own kind of homemade forums. And I guess everyone was using aliases before social media, you know, distributed that to the masses. And how do you reverse engineer people, like by their like little breadcrumbs they drop about their personal identities or their writing styles? Or are you looking at like technical data, like IP addresses?
The way I did it was, I mean, especially early on, they would happily provide information to me initially. They would post their pictures on Stormfront, for example, or they would share their social media, Facebook, for example, when it was first becoming the big thing at the time. When they started to kind of hide things a little bit, then you kind of go in a little bit more surreptitiously. I create socks on social media, for example, and I get into their groups. I never interact with them. I'm the only interaction I will do will be, well, thank you for inviting me. I appreciate this. I hope I could contribute to the cause. And then I stay silent and let them speak and kind of record either mentally or physically what they say and what other little hints they give to me as to who they might be. Of course, on Facebook, some people still provide their real names, their real identities. Those that don't usually provide enough information within a few months, maybe a few years, to be able to figure out who they are. And I'm always was very patient.
But by creating socks, you mean sock puppet accounts, which I guess in traditional journalism we'd call going undercover.
Precisely, yes.
Back to the siege on the Capitol, you can look at the breadcrumbs that people have left afterwards, and it seems like everybody there was telling on themselves and documenting their own crimes. But there were pre-breadcrumbs, there was planning, and yet it seemed to catch everybody unawares. Did you know that was going to happen before it happened?
I think most people who were in this world knew what was going to happen. Maybe not to the degree or in the way that it did, but we knew something was going to happen. There was chatter online for weeks prior to this. And one of the things that was always frustrating about to me about when I was writing the blog was that I could see a member of a hate group committing a particular crime, and they'll report on it, but they don't mention the fact that he belongs to, say, you know, Aryan Guard or Blood and Honor or Volksfront. So there's no context to it. I mean, they attack somebody of color, but they only talk about the assault. They don't talk about it as if it was a potential hate crime. And I see more of that here. People want to believe that this is novel. This is not something that's new. And certainly, you know, not something that white people do. I mean, white people don't riot. They don't do any of this kind of stuff. That's only, you know, those people over there. And the reality is, I mean, we've seen it year after year, decade after decade. This is the same thing that's happening. And it's often frustrating when you see it, you've reported upon it, you tell people, you provide information, and nobody or very few people appear to act on it.
And what do you do when you learn something, when you learn somebody's identity or of a plan? What do you do with that information?
Well, when I wrote for the blog, if I was 100% certain of the identity of the person, I would, you know, post to the blog. I would never post any other identifiable information in terms of their address or their phone number. But I would say this person's involved in this and people need to be aware of it in their community. I knew the blog was viewed by a number of people, activists certainly, but also law enforcement. That, you know, that wasn't a surprise. You know, since leaving the blog, I had a number of people in law enforcement actually contact me and see if there was anything else I could provide to them, interestingly enough. It was always very funny. I also had people who were in these kind of hate groups follow the blog. I think they viewed it as their version of the National Enquirer, keep up on their rivals within the hate group movement.
So you would say, it's not like you'd call the cops and it's not like you'd say, let's go to their house. And maybe if I'm hearing you right, some things that people do these days when they're, you know, calling people's employers and saying, hey, how do you feel about employing a Nazi? You were just making the information available and saying, hey, just FYI, this might be your neighbor. This is their name. They are a member of this Aryan Nazi group. So let it be known. Do I have that right?
Yeah. Very rarely would I call people to action. The only times I could really remember would be when I found somebody that was in the military, for example, and say, you know, this is a person that's in a position of authority, possibly training for nefarious purposes in the future. Contact the Department of Defense. I was thinking of one person who was involved in the Navy, for example, a number of years ago, and then another individual who, you know, to the credit, they did act upon it, and the media acted upon it, was a young reservist who was planning on attending one of the White Pride marches in Calgary. I think it was in 2011 or 2012. You know, the media actually covered that. They talked about this, and a spokesperson with the Department of Defense said they were looking into it, and that person ultimately never did go to that rally.
So your information has been useful to authorities. It's been useful to law enforcement. It's been reported on by the press. Does that happen a lot? Do you get into active partnerships with journalists, or do journalists just, you know, use information that you sleuth out?
I think for the most part, especially early on, they found it, they would use it. I wasn't necessarily contacted, but I knew quite often some of the sources they got would be the blog. Later on, as I became, I guess, more established, wasn't going anywhere. I think, you know, a lot of journalists had more comfortable contact with me.
Kurt, you are a hated person by hateful people and some dangerous hateful people. Have you ever come face to face with any of them?
No, which is in some ways surprising. I mean, when I was initially doxxed, I was certainly nervous that something would happen. In some ways, I was kind of blessed by the pandemic. You know, other news took priority.
Do your students know about this part of your life?
Well, they didn't then. They did when I got doxxed. I've always made a point of not including my political leanings in my classroom. But, I mean, being opposed to racism isn't, you know, well, it is a political issue, but isn't a partisan political issue. A person on the political left should be as opposed to racism as a person on the political right, for example.
I don't think you have to explain. You know, I think it's okay for a teacher to be opposed to racism.
Precisely. I certainly thought so. But it was funny when I got doxxed. My students were actually in the middle of a diploma exam. But I said to them, so you may have heard some things about me. Just know that I always make a point of not bringing my politics in the classroom. And hopefully you don't feel uncomfortable around me. And one of my students, you know, you know, I had a large number of Filipino students in the classroom. She said, Mr. Phillips, we're okay. You're good.
You referred to getting doxxed. I know that you did this work anonymously for a long time. In fact, you were on an episode of our podcast, Commons, under a pseudonym. Anything you want to say about being exposed in that whole experience?
It was a surreal experience. I had always assumed the possibility of being doxxed. I knew people were looking for me, and I knew I was pretty good at keeping my identity secret. I had these groups were kind of looking down every single rabbit hole that I'd left for them. So I had, you know, prepared for scenarios A, B, C, D, and E. I hadn't prepared for scenario F. And that was the one that kind of threw me for a loop. A person who I one time thought as a friend released the information about me in a purely malicious, you know, intent. I got personally very little response from these groups and these individuals. I got a few hate messages sent to my real social media Facebook page. But for the most part, they're being sent to my PACE employment, my family, my parents got a bunch of messages saying that they couldn't wait to have somebody put a bullet in my head. But I got very little of it. It was like being at the center of a hurricane. Yeah, it was like being at the center of a hurricane and seeing everything whipping around you, but not having the power to stop it.
That's a tricky one, isn't it? Because it's sort of like sometimes when these things happen, people say, well, look, if you just close your eyes and pretend it isn't happening, has anything really changed? Sticks and stones, right? No, this actually does have tremendous impact. I mean, for your parents to be told that, it doesn't take a lot to make people live in fear.
I mean, I'm sure that must have been incredibly stressful for them and for my younger brother, but they dealt with it very well, all things considered. And my mother, who, God love her, she's got a bit of a mouth on her too. When she sees something wrong on the internet, she wants to correct it. She's very much a big supporter of social justice, and she was discreet. She sent the information to the appropriate people. And I don't doubt that they got a lot more than they told me and are kind of holding back because it was tough. And they didn't want to cause me any more anxiety than I was already going through.
Can you talk a little bit about, like, I don't know, the hot new trends you've noticed in racism? Like, you've seen this, like, go from, like, just the sweatiest armpits of the internet to, I don't know, larger sweaty armpits. I don't know what the analogy is, but you've seen this thing explode. You've seen the look of it, the feel of it, the people, who they are. All of that has changed, and has it gone mainstream? I don't know. It seems like a lot bigger than it was when you started. How would you describe the arc of this whole thing?
I think these movements always come in waves. There's an uptick and eventually decline. You know, if you want to even go back to the KKK of the 1920s, I mean, at one point there were 25,000 members in Saskatchewan, and within a few years, it had declined to almost nothing. The Heritage Front, by 1992, 93, it was at its height, and then it declined precipitously. And right now we're on a particularly, you know, long-lasting and very high wave. I've told people that things were easy when I first started. You knew who the bad guys were. They were the, you know, they dressed stereotypically, you know, in leather bomber jackets, shaved heads, Doc Martens. One of the trends that we've seen is the radicalization of people who wouldn't normally have gone down that route. Social media has done an incredible amount of damage to our society as a result of this. We have at our fingertips access to more information than we've ever had in human history, but also access to more disinformation and bad players who are willing and knowledgeable enough to be able to use that to manipulate people. Some of my own relatives have got caught up into the QAnon conspiracy. That's one of the big ones, of course, this overriding, overarching conspiracy theory that encompasses all others. And if you're a rational person just looking at it from a distance, you think that the world is controlled by satanic, pedophile, child-eating Satanists. Okay, that doesn't make any sense. But Twitter and Facebook and other platforms are now trying to put the genie back in the bottle. They could have done something long before, but they chickened out on that. And they created a monster. And we're dealing with the repercussions, and we'll be dealing with those repercussions for years. You know, Trumpism isn't dead. It's just taking a different form now.
Can you talk a little bit about that shift from encountering people as mysterious, malicious, other people who need to be unmasked, but then seeing people in your family start to nibble at that which leads to that, or maybe is already a part of it, you know, QAnon being kind of like a popularized entry point to these theories. You teach high school students. You teach young people who are trying to make sense of the world. I'm just curious if that whole process of radicalization is something that you contend with much.
What I do in my classroom is, you know, like any teacher, we teach how to critically think, how to use our critical thinking skills, and discussion of, well, what is a proper website? What is a proper source of information? What is it? What is trying to manipulate people? So what do I do with my own students is what I hope people will do just naturally with their own families. I view the QAnon and other similar conspiracy theories related to it, perhaps, as, I don't know, you've probably heard of examples of people who are in a riot, and they're acting as a group, not as individuals. By getting people to think for themselves and by calling them out, you begin to get them thinking, kind of move out of that, possibly, to, okay, well, that doesn't make any sense.
I wonder if it works. I remember that quote, you can't reason someone out of a belief that they didn't reason their way into.
That's true. And it's one of those things I've been trying to contend with. I think we all have in all of our lives. We have, I think most of us have loved ones who might have differing opinions politically, but you still love them. Now they have gone in such a direction that it's really hard to view them as the same person. And I wish I had a ready answer of how to deal with that, particularly those people who have already gone down those rabbit holes. At this point, I'm trying to prevent people from going down in my own life.
Yeah, well, you're doing two things. I mean, what you do in the classroom is different than what you do online, and trying to engage people in critical thinking, which is difficult because some of the impulses that lead people to these conspiracies are the right impulse. You should question people in power. If you think that the posture of the Clintons as people who are trying to help the regular folk is, you know, perhaps hypocritical or false, you're right. Investigate that, interrogate that. But then it just goes wrong so quickly. And then on the other hand, you're online, and what you do there, you're not trying to inform, as I understand it, or talk people out of their beliefs. If I am not mistaken, you're trying to publicly shame them. And I say that without judgment. Perhaps we need more shame. And I wonder, in your opinion, what works better against radicalized racism, public shaming or criminalization?
Well, that's tricky, right? Because, I mean, on the one hand, I don't like shaming people. I don't like embarrassing people. But on the other hand, if you have beliefs that are so harmful that people act on them, that people are willing to hurt people because of those beliefs, I think they need to be exposed. I think that what I've been doing, and again, I can't speak for anybody else, but what I was doing was helpful. One of the things that was really satisfying for me over the years were people who had been in hate groups who got out of them, and partly because of the things I was writing about. People began to kind of think about their values. Why did they believe this in the first place? Why did they go down this road? And a lot of them contacted me and saying that, you know, I was one of the people who helped get them out of it by getting to question their assumptions. A lot of these young people were quite young when they got in, especially initially when I first started the blog. They were young people who were really looking for a place to belong, a place that was kind of a home for them.
I think maybe the elephant in the room is a lot of people aren't that smart, and a lot of people don't want to get smart. If there's some benefit to being a part of something, one thing that is really underexamined is how much fun these trolls and griefers and racists have had in recent years, seeing that they can like change the world from their desktops. I think that the effect and the value of what you and others do is make it less fun. Like, dude, you're not Batman. You don't get to have a secret identity. And I think what you're doing there is fighting fire with fire, in that it was some level of socialization and the appeals of that club that made that a thing in the first place. And it's sort of an assertion of a wider socialization, which is, well, here's what society thinks of you. As far as I could tell, that's the most effective. That's what worked after Charlottesville, was you don't get to just be in a secretly in this club.
Right. And I think that's the thing you're trying to get, is that if you expose the people, like, these are people who truly believe, and a lot of the time, a lot of them really genuinely believe that everybody feels the same way they do because of the echo chamber that they're in. Another reason why I published the blog and wrote articles for the blog was, as you said, to get that information out that, no, this is not mainstream. This is not what everybody believes, and especially as things evolved. I mean, as the, you know, the neo-Nazi type of racist became less prevalent, they were always still there, but they weren't as significant. They're, you know, now at the Soldiers of Odin, the Yellow Vesters, these other groups that emerged, presenting themselves as concerned citizens about our society and what's going on with it. But, you know, dig a little bit deeper, there's the same anti-Semitism, same Islamophobia, the same racism you see prior to that. And, you know, trying to expose and say, look, you believe that you are the mainstream. You are not the mainstream. People do not agree with you. Most people do not agree with you. You know, you'll find your subculture somewhere online, but that doesn't mean that that is what most people accept. And the thing about that is that too many people in Canada, the United States, around the world, don't know about this subculture. They don't know about these kind of groups that are around. It's very easy to, you know, to ignore it and believe that it's fringe, because it is fringe. But as we saw in Washington, D.C., at the Capitol building, even fringe groups could cause a lot of damage. They could be very dangerous.
Why do you think we generate so many of these people in Canada? Like, we seem to produce comedians and bigots and extremists. I'm thinking everybody from Gavin McInnes and Faith Goldie, and there's a spectrum, I suppose. And heaven forbid that I paint them all with the same brush, but there are, you know, Soldiers of Odin people we've mentioned, and then more mainstreamized versions of, I think, far-right media sources, rebel media. It goes on and on. Yellow Vests. What's the deal with Canada and this stuff?
Well, Canada really has punched above its weight in this kind of world, which is, you know, sad. But I think part of that is because the Canadian belief that this doesn't exist here. We ignore it. We don't acknowledge that it occurs. And when you don't acknowledge something as possible, it allows it to take place. I mean, a lot of Americans recognize this as a part of the American landscape. Canadians, we like to be smug and think, no, that's something that happens in the United States. It doesn't happen here. And in our smugness, we allow it to fester without really, you know, putting a spotlight on it and preventing it from occurring.
Finally, I just wonder, like, personally, no one gets out of anything unscathed. And, you know, what do they say? Like, you know, stare into the void stares back, and wrestle not with monsters lest you become one. Do you ever get tired of spending so much time with these people, you know, watching them, reading them, tracking them? Is it something you've thought about, you know, hanging up your cleats?
Well, when I started the blog, I always talk about, I don't have no ego. People want to use the information for whatever purpose, as long as it's a useful purpose, journalist, what have you. I'm fine with that. But I did have an ego. I really believed I was untouchable. I could look at these individuals and groups almost from an academic point of view and emotionally detach myself from it. Over the years, it became really apparent that that's not possible. And towards 2016, I was really beginning to feel it. And I was thinking then of hanging things up then. I had done my time. I'd fought the good fight. I, you know, lasted longer than most anti-racist activists do online. So I thought, well, you know, I'll wait for Trump's inevitable defeat and things will calm down a little bit and I could, you know, bow out gracefully. And that didn't ultimately happen. And yeah, I mean, I burnt out. I couldn't go full out like I had been. Like, I was producing at one point, you know, 150, 200 articles a year, you know, exposing these kind of groups. I don't think I could have kept up that pace for another 12 years.
It must have been lonely work and very specific work that I'm not sure many others were doing for a long time. It seems like a whole practice is developing around it, and there are funded organizations and very sophisticated new techniques. Bellingcat, just one group among many, and then this work is getting distributed among so many people. I wonder if that might be a way in which you could feel good about passing the baton onto the next generation of digital Nazi hunters.
That's true. When I first started, I really was essentially the only game in town. But yeah, I think one of the things I really appreciate seeing is the change. Not just in online activists and the groups that have established, like the Canadian Anti-Hate Network, for example, is just one among many. But even the journalism, I think, is improving too. It's not where it should be quite yet, but I think there's a greater recognition that these are groups that need to be dealt with, and they are worthy reporting. When I first started, I would send information to journalists, friendly journalists, who are interested in the subject matter, who are told by their editors, well, Canada doesn't really have a problem with racism. Nobody's going to be interested in reading that. So it got shelved. We don't see it being shelved as much now.
Well, that is really interesting. And it's really interesting how the suppression of stories like that feed right back into the conception that we don't have things like that here.
Exactly. And that was one of the things that always frustrated me. Like, you say we don't have racism. I'm showing you we have racism. We have a lot of it.
And can't publish it. No racism here.
Precisely.
That is your Canada Land. Listen, if this show has become one of the ways in which you get your information each week, I want you to think about supporting us, because of course we do need support to do this journalism, and it's so easy to give us $5 a month and get an ad-free feed and other stuff when you go to canadaland.com/join or just click on the link in the show notes. You can email me at jesse@canadalandshow.com. I read everything you send. We're on Twitter at Canada Land. Our website is canadaland.com, where you can sign up for our newsletter, which is also a great way to stay in touch with everything that's going on because it summarizes all of our podcasts and articles each week. Our producers this week are Kasia Mihailovich and Rosalind Kufour. Mixing by Jeremy Kessler. Our managing editor is Andrea Schmidt. Our theme music is by So Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. If you like this show, please support it.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.